The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Here to be here. Should I do a sound check? Is the volume okay? Yes. Okay. So I thought I would share a little bit about a saying that I heard recently, a Zen saying that has stuck with me, that's kind of been tumbling around in my mind a little bit. Sometimes with these Zen sayings, I'm like, oh, that's great. But wait, what does it mean? You know, I kind of, sometimes they feel a little bit enigmatic. This one is from the third Zen ancestor, and this is just a line from a greater poem. And it goes like this. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Right, therein lies the rub, right? So this idea of what is this great way? Because just last week I was visiting some of my family members after returning from a long retreat. And we were all going to dinner. We were in one car. I was a passenger in the car. And one of the other passengers was telling the driver, well, you really should have gone down 4th Street because that would have been faster and then you could make that turn on, you know, something or other. So right there was this kind of this preference that kind of led to a little bit of some agitation. And then, well, maybe you should park over here because then it's closer and then that car next to you, you know, this kind of thing. And I thought, I don't know about the great way, but just the way to the restaurant is easier. If you're not kind of tied up with your preferences of exactly how you get there, right, or where you park. So we could think about the great way as just being our life, our everyday experiences. It could be about why we practice, you know, to find ease, peace, well-being, sense of freedom. And also in kind of in the Buddhist sense too, is the liberation, freedom, nibbana, nirvana. It also can be the great way. And there's this idea the great way is not difficult, which suggests that there's a kind of a naturalness to it or an ease to it, things that aren't difficult. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about often like these depictions of the Buddha, right? When we see statues of the Buddha, he's not striving usually, right? He has a certain ease about him. Same with Kuan Yin, the bodhisattva of compassion, right? She's kind of seen with an ease and an uprightness as well. So for me, that's what I'm thinking when I think is not difficult. It means there's a calmness associated with this great way. But then there's this part, for those who have no preferences. Of course, it's not really possible to have a human life without having preferences. We prefer to eat than to starve, right? We prefer to have clothing than to not have clothing and all these obvious things. So I think the Zen master here isn't pointing towards being completely without any preferences. We prefer to do good in the world. We prefer to take care of the people that we love. We prefer to take care of ourselves. I think what's being pointed to is to have preferences, but to hold them in a way that doesn't cause difficulty, in a way that takes away from a sense of ease. To have preferences, but to not be identified with them, to be completely tangled up with them, that I need to have the ketchup on the side of my plate, not touching the French fry so that I can get the, just the right amount of ketchup on each French fry. Right? That may be our preference, but to kind of let it go if the food arrives with ketchup all over the French fries. Right, these may be silly examples, but these are ways in which in our daily life we can notice where we have preferences, but hold them lightly. In fact, we could say maybe be equanimous with our preferences. And this idea of equanimity is what I'd like to kind of explore a little bit today, because I'd like for all of us to be able to find a way that is not difficult. A way in our lives, our everyday lives, as well as in our spiritual lives, a way that has ease. So how can we work with those preferences that we have? How can we cultivate equanimity? And importantly, what can we do when we are completely tangled up with things that, with what's arising, when we're not feeling equanimous? Because that's just a part of the human experience as well. So we can think of equanimity as being defined as being impartial. It's being without bias or being without prejudice. It's a balanced engagement with life, and it's an opening to the whole of life with composure and ease of mind. It's accepting the beautiful and the terrifying aspects of life. And it has a sense of spaciousness to it, right? Kind of spaciousness comes with ease and calm and peace. Equanimity is that experience where we're balanced and not being pushed around by our emotions, being pushed around by our preferences, being pushed around by our experiences. Instead, able to hold the experiences, maybe in a balanced, steady way, with composure, maybe with some uprightness, we can imagine. I think it doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a Buddhist practitioner to know that having some ease and spaciousness and balance leads to an easier life. It's difficult when we're being pushed around, I guess I'll use that expression, by what we read in the news or what we hear in the radio or what's happening in the workplace, what's happening at home. Of course we're affected by these things, but our life can unfold with greater ease if we can respond with wisdom as opposed to just react and then fly off the handle or immediately feel bad about them. I think all of us know this. We all have this experience that when we have some amount of calmness, for whatever reason we have the calmness, things unfold with a greater ease and we're able to access our greatest wisdom in that way, the wisdom that we all have. But also, when we have a certain amount of calmness or ease, we can see that it is the nature of things to arise and pass away. There isn't anything that doesn't arise and pass away. Things that are come into existence eventually will leave existence. What's different, right, is maybe the speed in which they leave. And we can see that things arise due to conditions. It's not completely chaotic and it's not random. We may not know all the conditions, but if we have some calmness or ease, we can start to see that, in fact, things arise for reasons. And they go away for reasons, too. And so that can help bring some ease to understand, oh yeah, of course I'm agitated. I've just been surfing the internet for the past few hours looking for something to buy my brother for a gift, you know. So that kind of gives the sense of agitation. So it's not surprising, right? Instead of blaming myself or something like this, we could just notice, oh yeah, of course I feel this way. So you'll see in all these descriptions that are in the way that I've been describing it, equanimity is not indifference. It's not disengagement. It is not disconnection, and it's not apathy. All those are based on fear. They have a little bit of fear underneath them that are kind of fueling them, this disconnection or disengagement or indifference. Whereas equanimity is a balanced engagement. It's a opening to the whole of life, all of our experiences, but doing this with a sense of composure and ease. This is why I like kind of, I'm thinking of equanimity as impartiality. Impartiality implies more a little, for me, it doesn't have the coldness maybe that equanimity kind of sounds like, which can often think, we can think like it's just an indifference or not paying attention to you or something like that. So there are different aspects of equanimity, impartiality. One is courage. Sometimes it takes courage to have to face directly what's actually here. If we are going to have a balanced engagement with what's happening, we have to actually see what's happening, not allowing our fear to compel us to turn away. But sometimes it takes courage to actually really see what's really happening, and a willingness to open up and allow the feelings that may arise to be held in kind awareness. And there are times when we have greater capacity to do that than other times. Not always are we able to just be with feelings, with our emotions or our thoughts with kind awareness. But having this courage to turn towards what's actually there, even if it's just briefly and even if it's just sometimes, is where we start. It's where, like, equanimity has these different aspects, right? So we need, we start where we are. So not only courage, but also the acceptance is required. So we may turn towards things and see how they actually are, but we may have to accept the possibility that things actually may not turn out the way that we wish. Maybe they aren't the way that we wish they were, and they're going to get worse, get even less like the way that we want them to be. There has to be a certain amount of willingness to kind of accept that, think about that, consider that, and to stop hiding from the idea that it may get worse. It may get better too, right? And there can be also a certain amount of ease when we kind of like face the reality and stop. You know, it takes a lot of energy to pretend like something isn't there. I'm going like this. This is for me how I kind of feel, like I want to turn my head away and like, oh, stop, stop. But this idea of accepting that it may be not what we want. And there can be a little relief, like, okay, this is what it is. The relief in stop fighting with reality. Stop trying to make things be different than how they are. And a third aspect of equanimity that I like to think about in a little bit different way than it's often taught, and that is a willingness to be surprised. That is letting go of the idea that we know exactly how this is going to turn out. Letting go of any notions that we have of what's going to happen. Letting go of attachment to outcome. I'm going to do this in order so that can happen. So this willingness to be surprised. Like, I know from earlier experiences, it's likely this thing may happen, but it may not happen too. So these three aspects to equanimity: courage, acceptance, and willingness to be surprised. And we can cultivate and work with all three of those, either separately or together. Excuse me here. So many of you may know that there's a teaching that in life, that we don't need a teaching to tell us this, that there, this idea of eight worldly winds, these eight vicissitudes. So these are four pairs of experiences. And what's interesting about this teaching or these experiences is that they occur in pairs. We don't get to choose just one. Both of them happen. So what are these pairs? Gain and loss. Pleasure and pain. Praise and blame. Fame and disrepute. They all happen to all of us. It's part of the human experience. We don't get to choose just pleasure. We don't get to choose just gain. We don't get to choose just fame. Earlier I was talking about equanimity helps us see that things arise and pass away, right? So things that are gained or lost. And we can see that, like maybe even during the meditation we did before we sat down here, maybe there was a certain amount of calmness or mindfulness that wasn't there at the beginning when you first sat down. Maybe you gained some mindfulness, and then maybe it left and you got lost in a thought and there was a loss of mindfulness. We could see this all the time in our daily lives, that things, we gain things and lose things, right? It's not rocket science. But somehow for me, it feels a little bit of a relief again to like, okay, that's the truth of the matter. And when things, when there's losses, sometimes heartbreaking losses, to recognize that that's part of the human experience. It doesn't mean that we're failing. It doesn't mean that we did something wrong necessarily. It doesn't mean that the universe is out to get us or, you know, something like this. It's just the way that it is. Gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pain and pleasure. These are the eight different experiences. And for me, this idea of fame and disrepute and praise and blame, I find it a little helpful too, because, I mean, it's just natural. We prefer to be praised than blamed, especially if the blame is not accurate. But I find it really helpful to remember that there are plenty of stories in the early Buddhist literature of the Buddha himself being praised and blamed, and how he kind of worked with that. And he had a certain amount of fame for some people and a certain amount of disrepute with other people, right? None of us are immune to any of this. But when we have some equanimity, we can have some calmness and some steadiness in the midst of these changes, these inevitable changes. So, just like these eight vicissitudes are part of our life, meditation practice, Buddhist practice, as well as our regular life, equanimity is also a core teaching in a lot of Buddhist practices. If you've read some of the books on Buddhism, if you've been coming here for a while, if you've been practicing for a bit, you probably know that there are a lot of lists, right? These Buddhist lists. I'm one of those people that love these lists. But rather than giving you specific lists, I'm going to give you a list of lists. So we'll start with the seven factors of awakening. Sounds like the title is descriptive. It's a list of seven things that support awakening. Also, as an aside, last year, I guess it ended just this summer, was a seven-month program taught by Matthew Brand-Silver, Nikki Mirgafori, and Max Erdstein that was taught here on the Seven Factors Away. And it was excellent. I thought it was really great. I participated in that. What I'd like for you to take away is from this Seven Factors of Awakening is the seventh factor, the last one, is equanimity. There's also this teaching on the 10 perfections. For those of you who participate in the Dharma practice days on Fridays, Gil right now is going through the 10 perfections he teaches. And these are also qualities that help with awakening and help with our life. The first one is generosity. The 10th one, equanimity. There's also the four Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, these four practices of love, and loving others and however we meet them, whether they are suffering or whether they are having joy, and whether we are able to help them or not. So these four, it's a short list, I can tell you. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. Fourth one, equanimity. And then there's this other list of four, the four jhanas. These are meditative states of concentration. The fourth one, one of the dominant experiences of that meditative state is equanimity. So what all these lists have in common, of course, is equanimity, but also that equanimity is the last element in all these lists. And that points to that equanimity is what arises when there's a purity or of mind and heart, when there's a calmness of mind and heart. So it's a it's what arises when we've been practicing with other elements. And it's also, in the Buddhist teaching, equanimity is the precursor to awakening, to enlightenment. It's like the penultimate state before there's an awakening experience. So we can see that equanimity can make our lives unfold better, but it also is important in this movement towards awakening. In this way, maybe we could think of that as part of the great way. So you may be thinking to yourself, okay, this equanimity, it sounds interesting, it sounds good. Yeah, I don't think people are going to disagree with that. But the truth of my experience is that I am often angry, I'm often sad, I'm often bewildered by what's happening. So how can this equanimity teaching work for me, somebody who maybe doesn't have a, or feels like they don't have a lot of equanimity? And this is what I love about the Buddhist practice here, is that there's room for everything. There's room for everything, including not being equanimous. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the experience of not being equanimous, not having equanimity, not having peace, not having calm, not having ease. How can that be a part of our practice? How can that still be part of our practice instead of something that we're going to try to push away? Right? I was defining equanimity as a balanced engagement with all that arises or all that we experience. And sometimes what we're experiencing is rage or sadness, loneliness, confusion. So how can those experiences also support our practice to equanimity, and how can we bring equanimity to them? So in some ways, the entire practice may be understood kind of simply in a very generalized way as paying attention to when we have ease, peace, calmness, and when we don't have ease, peace, and calmness. Just that simpleness right there of noticing what kind of conditions support ease. What kind of conditions support having unease? What does it feel like in the body to have ease, peace, balance? What does it feel like in the mind to have ease, peace, and balance? And what does it feel like when we don't have that? When we are agitated, when we don't have ease, when we don't have peace, when we're feeling very unbalanced. We can learn a lot from this investigation, from just examining those two things. So one way to cultivate peace and balance is to investigate what takes us away from it. So to notice when there is some calm. It doesn't have to be the most calm ever, but when there's a certain degree of calmness, this may arise during meditation, it may arise when you first wake up in the morning, maybe before you go to sleep, or I don't know, for me, sometimes I love having coffee in the morning. So for me, just sitting down and having this warm cup of coffee just makes me feel like, I have this experience. So notice when there's like a sense of ease. And then notice when that ease leaves. Most likely you'll be caught up in a thought or an emotion or some of that. So then when you are mindful again or aware again, you can investigate and examine, what was it that caused me to lose ease, that caused me to get off balance? What was it that happened in my mind or my emotional life? Because it will inevitably happen, right, that the calm will leave, right? Earlier I talked about these vicissitudes. There's gain and loss, right? We gain calmness and we lose calmness too. But we can gain a greater self-understanding when we can learn or investigate or discover, what do we like sacrifice our calmness for? What do we treat as more important than a sense of balance? If we do an investigation into this, not a big, complicated investigation, something like more like kind of dropping the question in, like, oh, what was that? What was I just doing there? Maybe you'll notice that you are lost in planning what you're going to do for the rest of the day. And that's just some information like, oh, okay, so I have this idea that planning is more important than being calm, or is a way that I think that planning is a way to keep the calmness. And then maybe we can have some psychological insights. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. We don't have to dig for them. They just arise when they're ready to arise. But we may learn that, oh, actually, I feel like I need to plan because I have this sense of fear. And that was starting to bubble up. And the part of the fear was the fear that the calmness was going to go away. So in this way, we can use those moments when we're not equanimous, or not balanced, when we're lost in thought about planning, as a way to kind of help us for some self-greater understanding. And that greater understanding can help us cultivate equanimity, can help us to understand ourselves better. And with that, then we can help create the conditions that support peace and well-being. So we can discover some of our underlying beliefs. I talked about planning. Underlying beliefs may also be something like, oh, I can't do this. Oh, I don't deserve this. Oh, this is too hard. These may be some of our beliefs, and just having a recognition of those can really be helpful. But also, so those often were some of our thoughts, but also we can learn from what emotions are taking us away from the calm and from the ease. Again, briefly, we can investigate what are our entangling emotions. And if we're going to do this, it's helpful to keep notice the sensations in our bodies. Often it's so easy to get carried away with our emotions. I should say this about thoughts as well, right? So if we can feel the emotion in the body, or just have a connection with our body, then that allows us a little bit more space to have an investigation into these emotions. And one thing that we can ask ourselves, or to look at with these emotions that take us away from a sense of well-being, is there a sense of compassion in this emotion? For example, is there a wish for ourselves or others to be happy? Is there a wish for the world to be a better place? Is there a wish for someone to understand something important? Is there a wish for things to be better than they are? And so things that you may notice if you look at your emotions through these lens of compassion and kind of asking these questions, you may discover that fear has in it the desire to protect either ourselves or those we care about. Anger often wants the world to be happy and to work well for justice. Frustration often comes from the carrying sensations of anger being thwarted. Desire can be rooted in the wish to be happy for ourselves or for others. Judgment may come from the wish for things to conform to high standards. And sadness may come from a sense of how good things can be. So in this way, we can recognize that our emotions are a composite. They're complex. They're not just simple things. And we can, reflecting along these lines, noticing the compassion that's evolved in the emotions, whether it's fear or sadness or frustration, can shift our relationship to our emotions. We can recognize that there's skillful elements to them as perhaps some unskillful. Maybe we can rest a little bit in the skillful parts. If we can't do that, that's okay too. We can just recognize that it's a mixture of elements. And sometimes just that recognizing that there's a mixture and that it's not just this big black box called fear or anger or sadness, but that there's underlying wish for others to be happy, for ourselves to be happy. There's this underlying care for others or for ourselves. Recognizing that, we can cultivate that, can help us to have a little bit more ease, can help us to have a little bit more spaciousness with these entangling emotions. And that spaciousness and ease can be the fruit, can be the start of equanimity. It can be the create the conditions for equanimity. It itself may be equanimous. So in this way, we can remember that often there is love and wisdom that are mixed in even to our most difficult emotions. And we can grow in wisdom and kindness without blindly shutting ourselves down when we're having these difficult emotions or things that seem to overtake us. I'll say for me that out of reading this list, had a really big impact on me when I was feeling fear, a lot of fear. And then to kind of tease apart, like, what is it really, this fear? It's like, oh yes, it's born out of a caring and wanting to protect. And that kind of helped me to be with it, right? Instead of being afraid of the fear, to be with, oh yeah, there's some goodness here. There's some skillfulness here. There's some wholesomeness here. I think this is true for almost all of our experiences, right? That there's a mixture of them. Maybe some skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. And recognizing that, we don't always have to think about the painful, unskillful, unwholesome aspects of our experience, our actions, our thoughts, our emotions, our behaviors. We can also notice the good parts of them. And we can remember that this quality of compassion that we experience in our emotions is present in all beings and everyone. And that their unskillful and confused attempts they made to find happiness in the end of suffering is kind of often born out of this idea of some compassion in there, this wish to have an end of suffering. And then can we harness the energy of this compassion, recognizing that it's there, to act in alignment with our core values? Can we use it to get clear about what our core values are if we notice the compassionate part of our emotions? And can we harness compassion as this idea of wanting to end suffering, so that energy of wanting the suffering to end, can we harness that energy and use it to have us act in a way that's consistent with our aspirations, consistent with how we want to be in the world? So I talked a little bit about equanimity, how it's helpful both in our daily lives. It's also helpful, maybe even essential for the Buddhist practice towards awakening. I talked about what to do if we were not feeling equanimous. We can look at those when we have calmness and what takes us away from that. And we can work with our difficult entangling emotions and discover some of the skillfulness and compassion that may be a part of it. I'm going to briefly talk about just a little bit about how can we specifically cultivate equanimity? What are some practices that we can do? Maybe I'll start that saying that equanimity grows naturally with our meditation practice. Even if we didn't do any specific practices for equanimity, it would naturally grow. You may have an experience of this, of sitting on the floor, for those of you who sit on the floor, and maybe some of you who are currently sitting in a chair, that often, this was my experience, when I first was doing this, my foot would go to sleep. And it was terribly uncomfortable, and I would get very agitated, and should I move? I don't want to move, and maybe I got to, oh my gosh, I got to move. You know, kind of getting, like, struggling with it. But then after it happened for 100 times, 200 times, I don't know how many times, I started to feel like, oh, okay, this just happens, and it'll go away when I shift my posture, and I don't have to shift my posture right now. I could hold it with some balance, with some ease, after I experienced it quite a number of times, right? I just learned how to do that. So in this way kind of equanimity just happens, whether we intend for it to or not, whether we're specifically practicing it. But I'm going to talk about some ways that if we choose to, that we can specifically cultivate equanimity. So one is, we can use the body as a support for equanimity. I've been talking about thoughts and emotions primarily, but with this practice, right, we notice how the body and mind are, right, very much intermingled. And so if we talk about equanimity being a balanced engagement with life, then we can, with our meditation practice, we can choose to take a posture that is really upright and balanced. And we can, a posture that's alert, kind of like dignified, composed, not uptight, but like strong, mature, available, maybe with the chest open, the back straight, and then make our posture the object of the meditation, and make a commitment to stay with this posture with as much ease as we can. So not engage in the struggle if we are finding some discomfort. Discomfort probably will arise. That's the nature of our human bodies. But we can use our uprightness in our physical form to help with uprightness and balance in our minds and our emotions too. So just practicing with that within our meditations of, and when the mind drifts away, as it will, just to come back to this sense of uprightness. But not with a way that we have a tightness about it and it has to be this particular way or something. But, you know, uprightness with some ease. So we can use our body and our posture as a way to support having equanimity, is in support to having balance. Another way is, as I mentioned, that equanimity is the fourth of the Brahma-Viharas, part of the loving-kindness practices. And for those of you who have done loving-kindness practices, you know that it's phrases that you repeat. So we can repeat phrases for equanimity. And without maybe doing formal Brahma-Vihara practice, we could just sit down to do equanimity practices by sitting with whatever calmness we find ourselves with and having phrases that maybe go with the exhale. So they're kind of, it's often easier to do this timed with the breath. And we could say, breathing in, breathing out, I calm the body. Breathing in, breathing out, I calm the mind. May I be balanced. May I be at peace. And then you repeat this. Breathing in, breathing out, I calm my body. Breathing in, breathing out, I calm my mind. May I be balanced. May I be at peace. This is something that we just repeat over and over in a relaxed way. Take our time with this. And then when you start to feel quiet and some balance and peace, you can broaden it into kind of more of a spaciousness, so that allow things to arise and pass away with a sense of equanimity. But also when we do these type of practices, often the opposite arises. All the ways in which we are not calm, all the ways in which we don't have balance, all the ways in which we don't have peace often arise. And if that's the case, then maybe we can work with those like entangling emotions that I just talked about earlier. We can look at them and maybe see some of the compassionate aspects of them. Or we can hold them as best as we can. Often it's really helpful to stay with the body, stay with sensations of the body when we're feeling entangled with emotions or thoughts or whatever's arising. And then this last practice isn't a meditation practice. It doesn't have to do with the body. It's a little bit more of a reflection. Is we can do reflections to help us see the bigger picture. I know that when I was a teenager, I had the great fortune to go to Europe with my family. And I was a teenager filled with all the teenage angst, my poor parents now, when I think back on this. But something about seeing those walls from the Roman times just really helped put in perspective. Really, it had a tremendous impact on me. Like, how many generations of people also, you know, the boy didn't like the girl and the girl didn't like the boy and the boy, you know, this kind of thing, right? It just really helped me to see like, oh, okay, so there's more to the world than my own experience, and there's a bigger perspective. So maybe in some ways we can bring to mind either generations of people before us. We can bring to mind the cosmos, right? That the I have this quote here from the cosmologist Brian Swim that I think is kind of helpful. He said, 4.5 billion years ago, that's a long time ago, the earth was a flaming molten ball of rock. And now it can sing opera. Right? Just that there's this giant unfolding happening, and we're part of that. So maybe it's helpful to kind of take this bigger perspective, can help us hold things with a little bit more balance and equanimity and ease. So in this way, there can be three practices. You know, different times, they're helpful in different ways, different times in our lives, different times during the day. First one being about using our body to have some balance and alertness and ease there. The second is about maybe repeating phrases, so very specifically to cultivate equanimity. And the third is to broaden our perspective by doing some reflection on the really big picture about what's happening. So with that, I wish you all some peace, ease, balance, well-being, and equanimity during this holiday season. Thank you.